I always tell people there's no upside to being heroic when you know the market's slow. Like, get the occupancy. You know, you can be in an offensive mindset when everyone's in a defensive mindset. Mm-hmm. If you know that you're already covered, like your nut isn't fully covered, that's a perfect time to go and get more units, get more concessions, get terms that you want, right? You can have that mindset. It's hard to play offense where you're like bleeding money, mm-hmm. but it's a lot easier, right? If you know that I'm not going to lose money this month, my high season's 2 months away, let's be aggressive.
Welcome to the Rich Drummers Report, where we talk real estate, business, and wealth building, all while keeping it real. No fluff, no BS. I hope that you enjoy the show. All right, guys, welcome to another episode of the Report. Today, I got a special guest who I just met out in Nashville, Tennessee for the STR Wealth Conference with my guy, Mike Shogren. That was a couple months ago in February, and connected out there, talk shop. And he actually went to school out here, college out here in San Diego. I got my man, Michael Chang. Michael, welcome to the show.
Rich, thanks for having me today.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you coming on. And dude, I didn't realize you went to college out here. So it's kind of like a homecoming for you.
Yeah, I always love coming back. I went to UC San Diego. So it's nice to hear with my wife, you know, come and meet you again, take some time away from the kids.
Yeah. You didn't bring the kids this time.
No, we got two young kids, so they're safely ensconced at home. I live in Manhattan, actually. I live in New York City.
Oh, shit. Okay.
New York City.
Dude, I was just out in Manhattan in November last year, and man, I love it out there, dude.
I'll let me take you out next time. We'll get some steaks. We'll hang out.
What's your favorite steakhouse in Manhattan?
Wolfgang's. Wolfgang's is a chain, but their first restaurant was in Tribeca, and it's right across from where I used to work at Citibank. I worked in the M&A group at Citibank, so we always go there. So I have like a very, very good feeling, impression in there. I've done like four or five birthday parties there, just did my most recent one there. So that's the best like steakhouse, my favorite steakhouse in New York City.
Okay. I like that. So I've heard of Wolfgang Puck's. This is different than Wolfgang.
This is different.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a very famous steakhouse in Brooklyn and he was the head chef there.
Okay.
He left and started his own thing. It was Wolfgang. And then he's bigger. He's way bigger than the original restaurant.
Interesting, dude. I was out there in November, caught a Brooklyn Nets game. I went to Italian dinner. It's a classic spot near Times Square called Carmine's.
Okay, yeah.
That was good. And then went to sushi, but the sushi, I got to admit, wasn't the greatest of the spot that we went to. However, it was late night after the Nets game, so I have to give it a pass. But what's your favorite sushi spot in New York, man? I'm curious.
It's a three-star Michelin restaurant. And the really cool part, I forget the name right now, but the really cool part of this place is they're open for lunch. And you get $10 hand rolls there for 10 minutes.
Wow.
You can't get the same hand rolls. You can't get like two of the same thing, but you can have like a 3-star experience for like, you know, 50, 60 bucks. You go in there, a few hand rolls. It's standing room only. It's really nicely done. And the dinner there is like very, very nice. It's hard to get a reservation. So it's just a very nice experience to have there. And the sushi's great.
Yeah. I love that, man.
You're catching all these names, Rich.
I know, right?
Forgetting all these names right now.
Yeah. So speaking of like, well-known chefs, I've had Brian Malarkey on this show. He's all over Top Chef and the Food Network. And he started a couple of big name restaurants here in San Diego that do really well.
Okay.
Urban Wood and Anime. He was on the show and he's trying to get in boutique hotels. And he's like, dude, Rich, like, let's do a boutique hotel project. And so I don't know where we're going to go next with it, but you know, we're going to close out this fund with this latest deal. I just signed on the loan docs today, closing tomorrow. I'm going to close out that fund, but in talking about next steps, I'm like, man, maybe I'll partner with someone like Brian, who can bring the restaurant portion and we can do a little bit bigger type of boutique hotel deal. And, you know, he can bring the food and beverage and we'll bring the hotel portion. So I don't know, man. I've always wanted to do like a really badass boutique hotel here in like downtown San Diego, a little bigger scale. Rooftop pool, nice food and beverage component, something that's like a cool vibey spot that people come hang out at before, after ball games, all that sort of thing. So I don't know. We'll see. But I've always wanted to do a little bit bigger stuff. So we'll see.
I mean, congratulations on getting to closing on your fourth hotel project. It's not, I know you're a day away. I don't want to jinx
it. It's not done yet. It's not, knock on wood.
You're on the 1 yard line.
Congrats
to getting to the 1 yard line. It's a difficult thing to do. And, you know, I haven't been back in San Diego for a few years now. Just seeing the development here on the waterfront, it's amazing. So it definitely could use a Rich Summers themed hotel here. What a good F&B.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I appreciate you. Yeah, it's definitely gentrified a lot. Especially this neighborhood, Little Italy, but now this is like the hottest, trendiest neighborhood in all of San Diego. if you go out here to India Street and just drive down, I mean, all the hottest restaurants, coffee shops, all the cool stuff is right there. And rightfully so. I mean, it's right on the water, close to the airport, and it's just a good, cool, vibey spot. What I love about this part of downtown is it's a neighborhood vibe. You don't see police cars. You don't see cops. You don't see homeless on this part of town. And
yeah,
yeah, I've been in this neighborhood 7 years now. So lived here 7 years. Our office is located here. We got a boutique hotel over on the north side of Little Italy. So, you know, we're growing some roots here. Yeah, yeah. So excited for it. But anyways, I want to jump into your story, man. So seven-figure Airbnb investor. You got 31 properties. How many of those 31 properties do you own personally?
So we own six of those properties personally. And the other, so we have 31 properties total. 25 of them are apartments that we rent and then re-rent on Airbnb using a strategy called Airbnb arbitrage. So there's 25 of them. And we took that cash flow, reinvested it into buying six vacation rental properties in Tennessee. The 31, and you know, knock on wood, just like you, we have an offer accepted on a property. I won't talk about the location because we worked really hard to find it. But number seven, hopefully, will be under contract by Monday.
Yeah. What were you doing before Airbnb?
So before Airbnb, I was a M&A investment banker, actually. I worked on Wall Street. I did my MBA at Cornell and, you know, the whole Wall Street thing after 2009. And, you know, we were looking for something. My girlfriend, then now wife, we were looking for something that to do together. And she loved real estate. And we looked for a couple things to do. And, you know, Airbnb was like, okay, this is something real here. And we did one and then did two and then four. And then here we are today.
Yeah. I love that, man. So you mentioned a lot of these units early on, the arbitrage stuff, or 25 of them are actually multifamily units. Are we talking large scale multifamily and you guys just rent a portion of the units? Or are we talking smaller apartment buildings, fourplexes, that sort of thing?
No, these are large multifamily buildings in the city of Philadelphia, commercially zoned, properly permitted and licensed. The smallest building right now has 90 some odd units. The largest one has over 300. We're only like 10 to 15 units within each building purposefully. And that cash flow from the arbitrage units allow us to, one, continue to reinvest into buying, either growing the arbitrage portfolio or buying properties. Two, provides the business scale for us to be able to go and, you know, acquire that seventh property and have a platform where we can just put it back into everything that we're doing so that, you know, we don't miss a beat and we kind of have that operational side cover.
I'm curious, does the cash flow with the arbitrage with these units out in Philadelphia, and I know they have strict short-term rental regulations out there. I was actually doing a 1031 exchange out of a property in Indianapolis. This is late 2021. And I was like looking in a handful of markets to put my money in. I knew I wanted to do something with the short-term rental game. I ended up going into a luxury property in Scottsdale with the proceeds, but mm-hmm. I was looking at some new construction sixplexes in Philly that were like really luxurious, really nice, high end. And I thought, man, that'd be kind of cool to do, you know, something with a sixplex and have six short-term rental units. So I was looking in the Philly market and I was like, okay, well, you know, some good pockets in Philly, some bad pockets of Philly.
There right? are some bad pockets.
And then I was looking more into the short-term rental regulations and that sort of thing. So I have a little bit of knowledge of the area, but I guess I'm curious with these arbitrage units, what kind of cash flow do they spit off monthly for one unit, averaged out over the entire year?
You know, in the aggregate, we target 30%+ cash on cash.
Cash on cash.
So, well, actually, let me reframe that. We target 30% cash margin. So, you know, if a property does $100,000 a year, we'd expect that property to cash flow after everything $30,000. That's the power of arbitrage, where, you know, we don't have that much money in the nice part is, you know, you're just investing in the FF&E into the units. The rent concessions generally cover part of that as well. And the hard part is identifying the right buildings in supply constrained markets, which is actually the really, you know, kind of some alpha for the listeners here. You want to find supply constrained markets that allow you to grow and where you don't have a kind of unlimited supply that comes in and brings down your rates. That is how you can grow like a successful arbitrage business. And for us, it's important also to be in larger buildings.
Why is that?
It's important because you get the benefit of their scale. There's a front desk person you're not paying for, right? There is on-site staff. There's on-site maintenance. There's all of that that is all taken care of by the rent, right? And you are just focused on your within your four walls, making sure that is operating correctly. And if you've diligenced properly that building, that operator, then it's a really nice relationship. You do the master lease with them. They know what, you know, they get their rent. You get certainty and you both run your business.
How do you go into a large apartment building and like what's the best way to position or frame rental arbitrage? Because I can imagine, you know, certain landlords probably don't want it, but then certain probably are open to it.
Yeah.
How do you position or frame it?
Well, I think, you know, some of it, my advantage of my background, right? I'm not someone that just kind of walked off the street. You know, I had a real career in investment banking. I can present in a way that I think they're, you know, like, okay, someone actually has thought about this.
Yeah.
You know, what, and how we treat our, you know, how we diligence our guests, how we operate. So doing that, presenting that in a way to a property manager, a property owner in the correct way is a big part of it. And, you know, there are people that I help that are now doing rental arbitrage as well. It's hard to just pick up the phone and call someone and say, hey, I want to take 10 units into your building. You're like, oh, who is this person? I don't know you, right? You have to have a warm intro that helps, but really just coming in with the right presentation, with how you present yourself, with the offer, that is a big part of opening up that conversation. Because if not, then you're just any other person that's calling them and trying to run a business from their business. And that's just a little harder to do.
So with a lot of these multifamily deals, like they got property management companies, sometimes often it's third party, and you go in, you're talking to maybe a leasing agent, and then there's maybe a manager that's there. But I believe those are not the ones making the decision. So how do you get in front of the decision maker? It's typically going to be who? The owner?
It's going to be... It's usually like a regional manager.
Really?
Depending on the building. But it's usually, if it's a self-managed building, then it definitely goes, you're right, it goes to the owner. If it's a larger national or regional operator, you definitely go above the building management person, the person that covers the region or the city. You hit the nail on the head there. Got to talk to the right person. Talking to the person in the leasing office is not going to do anything for you because they're not a decision maker. They're just there to do the paperwork.
Because I rent where I live. And, you know, in San Diego, it's a lot cheaper to rent. There's a lot of benefits and reasons why I rent in San Diego. You know, first and foremost, with the rate environment and property taxes, insurance and HOAs with all these condos where I live, right? By the time you factor all that stuff and then, you know, 10 or 15, 20% down payment, it would make zero sense for me to own, especially a high res. I don't want to own high res real estate, first of all. So it makes a lot more sense for me to rent. But these high rises that I rent in, they're like hard no with the residences in these lease agreements. There's no Airbnb allowed. Like it's a hard no. So I, at least with these buildings, I would be shocked if they, even if I went in there with this perfect game plan, all decked out to a T, I would be shocked that they allowed me to do it. But like, obviously you're finding success. So I'm curious, you know, obviously one, how do you get in front of those people? And then how do you convince them just to do it?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just me, right? It's also people that, you know, my peers, like funny. I met a person in Miami in January at a separate conference. And I was talking to him yesterday and he just closed 30 units in a market in Arizona, arbitrage units. Like he was able to source furniture at a low at a very good rate, and went to a building that had a lot of vacancy. Right, they had so this particular building just transitioned from student housing to traditional multifamily, and it was a ghost town. Someone there. So that's, you know, I think a big part of it is it's the opportunity identification as well.
Mm-hmm.
You go to a Class A building where you live, right? 97% occupied, beautiful amenities. They don't need someone, they don't need a Airbnb investor to go in there and take 20 units. They can do it themselves, right? You got to find an opportunity where they need you. They just repositioned the building. They just opened. There's some special circumstance there where they have 20, 30, 40 units that they need you to take. Now, we approach the game slightly differently. So we have our own sauce. That's why we have 25 only. We're not taking 30, 40 at a time, because we are looking for just the highest margin type units.
Mm-hmm.
But that is kind of the trick, is finding those buildings, those people that need you. Because if they're 97% occupied, yeah, you're right. It's going to be a hard no. They're like, why am I doing extra work?
Mm-hmm.
Right? They don't want to do the extra work. Like they want to do something else, right? It's because that they have, they're 10% occupied. Right? Imagine being 10% occupied. You'd be open to a lot of different creative solutions.
As a busy real estate investor or entrepreneur, time is money and first impression is everything. Every day to make it easy on myself, I wear Built Basics clothing. Whether you're a girl or guy looking for workout gear, joggers, shirts, button-downs, hats, or shoes, Built's got you covered. Super comfortable, tight in all the right places to make you look fresh and clean all the time. Visit BuiltBasics.com and use promo code SUMMERS20 to receive 20% off of your order. Again, that's BuiltBasics.com. That's B-Y-L-T Basics.com. Use promo code SUMMERS20 to receive 20% off of your order. Now back to the show. So with the 25 units, is this all in one building? Or is spread across a few?
Two buildings.
Two buildings. Got it. And what's the biggest risk to the arbitrage model in your estimation?
The most important asset in the arbitrage model, strategy, game, or however you want to term it, is the relationship with the property manager. It's all about relationships, right? You can never guarantee nothing goes wrong. There's always something that could happen. But building, maintaining, growing that relationship with the property manager, with that owner is paramount, because that's going to get you through volatility, right? Where you have something that unexpected happened, but they call you, they know you're going to pick up the phone, they know you're going to do your best to go and fix that problem. They know that you're going to pay your rent on time. They know you're going to pay your rent in full. They know that you're going to take care of your apartment. They're going to take care of their properties. I just had one property today where they emailed me and said, hey, we're doing a random inspection. And ours randomly gets inspected, of course. No worries. Go in. Take a look. It's perfect. So, you know, those are the things to answer your question, like that is the most important part of this, of mitigating the risks. Because if you lose that relationship with the landlord, then your lease goes away. They make it more difficult for you to run your business. And more importantly, you can't grow with them, right? Because, you know, they're in the business of developing more real estate. And you just happen to be that trusted solution where, like, hey, I just opened a 100-unit building. Rich and Michael, maybe they can take half of it, right?
Yeah.
Here for 6 years. And then as they scale up the building, and then it will, and then, you know, you slide down until the next building. You know, you offer a unique solution, a trusted unique solution. Mm. And that's how we position ourselves.
Yeah. We actually have 6 rental arbitrage deals ourselves. There's, I want to say 4 or 5 in Indianapolis and 1 in Scottsdale. I might be missing one. I kind of stay out of the operations and that sort of thing. But these were clients that we were doing property management on the short-term rental side for.
Yep.
And as you know, it's very seasonal in a lot of these different markets. And so we went to our clients and we said, hey, instead of having these P&Ls that go up and down with the different seasonality of these different markets, would you be open, or would you prefer just to have a fixed monthly steady cash flow? We can do a master lease, and we do lock you in a 36-month agreement, and then we'll pocket the spread. And then that way you can plan accordingly, and you can bank on having the same monthly income that comes in, pay your mortgage and all that sort of thing. It's not going to fluctuate. And then we get to pocket on the delta. And so we did that. A lot of them like it, but it's, you know, it's up and down, you know? So like we'll make money in the strong season, and then the slow season, we're actually losing a little bit of money. So, you know, it's part of the game, but that's my experience with the rental arbitrage. These are all single family properties though.
Yeah. You know, I think with single family properties, and depending on which market you're into, right, where there's more seasonality, we like to identify markets like Philadelphia is one. There are others that, you know, some of our partners are in as well. Some of our students are in as well, that we target low seasonality, where maybe January, February, like there's maybe 2 months that you're low. And, you know, there are other strategies that you can do to at least try to break even those months, namely get in front of it. Like if you know what's coming, just like if you're, you know, if you're all in expenses, 2K, get to, you know, just like, don't be heroic. I always tell people there's no upside to being heroic when you know the market's slow, like get the occupancy. You know, you can be in an offensive mindset when everyone's in a defensive mindset.
Mm-hmm.
If you know that you're already covered, like your nut is already fully covered. Okay, now it's low season. It's low season because for those markets where the long-term rental people are looking for occupancy too. So that's a perfect time to go and get more units, get more concessions, get terms that you want, right? You gotta have that mindset. And bleeding money is like hard to play offense when you're like bleeding money,
mm-hmm.
but it's a lot easier, right? If you know that I'm not going to lose money this month, my high season's 2 months away, let's be aggressive.
Give me an example of something you might do to be aggressive when you're maybe in the red.
We haven't been in a,
Okay.
We actually haven't been,
But let's just, you said slow season, January, February. And what's something you might do to be aggressive in that, in that?
Oh, yeah. So in that we will, you know, we're good at pricing management. So we'll try to get a long-term stay. We'll get a long, you know, longer-ish type stay, mm-hmm. 2-3 weeks where it covers most of the rent. And then the cleaning costs are low. Utilities are generally higher, obviously, because it's, you know, they're turning up the heat the whole time. But that's what we'll do. You know, we'll know that, like, we'll just slam down the prices, but have very long length of stay restrictions. So you can only book for 15 days, but you get a good price. But if you want, but and you can't book a shorter stay. So we want chunkier stays and just get it out so that, you know, now that we're in April 1st, we just got a new building in Philadelphia that we're working, that we just signed a contract for, and we're going to grow to another 15, 20 units there.
Nice. Congrats.
Right. Because, you know, because like we talked to them in January and February, and, you know, it's good. It's like hard to like make a big investment, right? That's like six figures of rent every single month, right? Yeah. You got to be in the right mindset.
Sure. So going in, you know, for maybe someone listening to this podcast and want to do an arbitrage deal, do you recommend going in and picking up 15, 20 units at a time without really having any evidence that it's going to work out? Or do you say, hey, just start with one or two. If it goes well, then you can expand.
Yeah, I definitely don't want someone to go in with 5, 10, 15 units if they don't have any experience. So you definitely want to do 2-3 at once. See if you're good at it. See if you like it, right? Because it is it's not just real estate, it's hospitality as well. You got to operationalize it. You know, but I think it's really important to do the work beforehand, right? Like identifying the right market, identifying the right building, negotiating the right lease. There are a lot of pieces in place. Like we've been able to refine this playbook over a number of years, right? We made mistakes at the beginning for sure when we first started in 2017.
Yeah.
And we negotiate our leases in certain ways. We underwrite in certain ways. You know, that just comes with experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You said insurance purposes.
Oh, no. So it's transferable also to like buying too, which is, you know, for us a very important component. You got to buy, right? You got to own. It's the ownership society here in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, debt and taxes is the play, right? And so with arbitrage, I think, you know, it's a great way to get started, but I think the end game should always be ownership. You know, with arbitrage, you have upfront costs, right? So down payment with the lease, if there's a deposit, rather. And then you're going to have your furnishing and all that sort of thing. Typically, how quickly do you like to recoup 100% of your funds? Because until you do that, you know, you're not profitable, right? Technically, if you look at it that way. So when you do a new unit, typically how quickly do you want to see those funds recouped?
Your payback should be about 6 months.
6 months.
Right. But remember, after 6 months, then you own a business free and clear, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you're like, you obviously have the mortgage / lease, right?
Yes.
But, you know, there are ways to structure the lease. You want to get your concessions up front, right? You want to not be paying rent for the first X weeks, X months to be able to recoup your costs. You recoup your, you know, to your point, your down payment, your FF&E costs and setup costs. But I think you'd be hard pressed to find a business model where you can have all your cash out of the deal, right? Where you're playing with, quote unquote, house money in 6 months. Pretty good.
Yeah.
But no, you know, to your point, like there are downsides to it too, right? You don't own it. So you don't have full control. You don't have the appreciation benefits. You don't have the tax benefits. So that's why we've done both strategies, right? Hybrid strategy or combination strategy, rather. Arbitrage, high cash flow, build out, operationalize the business, buy assets on top of that, and then it all works. And save taxes, get the appreciation, it all works very, very well.
Yeah. I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about your team, man. So, you know, obviously 31 units here. You know, you kind of, it's too big to do it on your own. And you know, so you need a little bit of a team here. So what does your team kind of look like?
So the most important player is my business partner, who's my wife. We started this business together when we were still dating, then we got married. So, you know, she is my thought partner. Like we do everything together. And we started this business together. We tore the boxes down. We built the furniture. We decorated, did all that fun stuff. But you're right. Like we can't do, like we don't spend time in operations now. We have a team of six virtual assistants that are based in Asia that run their entire business. And that's where, like, I think a little bit of my background in investment banking, in training and identifying good talent, and letting them be able to run the business. So there's some amazing talent overseas that work really, really, really hard for you, and you compensate them well. Our you know, we have staff that's been with us for like 3-4 years, which is like really, you know, we're very proud of that, like they've stayed within the family. But that's the operational part of it. We have six people that run this from a corporate perspective every single day, 7 days a week.
Wow. That's impressive, man. And that's cool that you're able to find some really good folks overseas. And these are folks that are in leadership positions and running the whole company.
My right-hand person, he is 25.
Wow.
He's been with me. He's 24, actually. He's been with me for 5 years now. Started working when he was 19.
Wow. That's impressive, man.
Yeah. And, you know, look, I mean, the cool part is see him grow as a person, as a professional. He runs a team. He runs the monthly meetings. You know, I think finding that person is a superpower, right? Like, he sees everything. Like, what I'm trying to do is, like, be me. Like, think like me in the business. So I don't need to, I can just ask him the questions and I get the responses. And that's really opened up my time to do other things, right? So I really believe in that Jeff Bezos, you know, he had a saying where you want to force decision-making down to as far down the organization as possible. So, like, we want to, because I'm not the best person to make decisions, generally speaking, in the Airbnb business. I don't know everything that's going on there. Those guys know. So it's like really empowering them to do that. So it's been really nice to not deal with the day-to-day part of that anymore.
How do you manage all of them? Because, you know, we have four VAs in the Philippines and we do like meetings in here, but Andrea on my team, she does a lot of like meetings and actually she does level 10 meetings with them. Just kind of make sure they're on the same page. I kind of stay out of that portion with them, but just curious how you manage the whole system because they're on the other side of the world, right?
I think one is culture, right? The culture part is, you know, we have monthly meetings. We have, you know, we use like Asana to track all the workflows. But, you know, I think fundamentally it's the culture that we built from the first person that joined us. Her name's Kathy. She's been with us for even longer. She's been with us since 18. I don't remember anymore. She's like the first person we hired. And just imparting on her, like the hard work, like not wasting money. That's a huge part of like the ethos of our company. Like we don't waste money here, right? Like we track all the KPIs to make sure that, you know, we're not overspending on linens, that we are not overspending on electricity, like the very minor details that if there is a sold towel, like we go and we air cover that. Like that $25 is not, like that's the ethos of the company. And that's allowed us to get those profit margins because everyone cares about this company making money because we were with them through COVID, right? When everyone's laying everyone off. And we're like, no, we're not going to lay you off, right? We're going to defer some of the pay now because like we don't know where this is going to be, but like we're going to work really hard to get through this. And like that thriftiness of that COVID experience now as we've grown has been a tremendous tailwind for us where, you know, like imagine having like 10 riches in your organization or 10 Michaels, right? Like that's really the superpower. Mm-hmm. And
nothing would operate if there was 10 of me in here. I know that. I'm a visionary, so it would just be completely chaotic and nothing would get done.
Having someone thinking with a CEO mindset, I think is like, you know, across all levels of organization, I think it's like super important. So we really try to emphasize that and we pay them very, very well, you know, and we incentivize them to make sure that they, you know, they think that way.
Yeah.
Comp is always the, you know, the driver to get the behavior that you want, but also that, you know, the culture too.
Yeah. Dude, I love that, man. Yeah, right before we started recording, I don't know if you noticed, Andrea came over here with a laptop. She's on a Zoom call with one of our top VAs, and he's been with us forever, but great dude. And so it was cool to see his face. We got to have him out here to San Diego sometime, you know? But that's cool, man. So tell me about the six deals that you own. Where are those at?
So they're all located in, and you'll see a common theme here. They're all located in the Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee.
Nice. Gatlinburg?
So, Sevierville, actually.
Okay.
Gatlinburg, the math and work out as well as in Sevierville, which is just the kind of town over. And we have six properties there. They're, you know, four are in basically 5 minutes from each other. So we really believe in, there's a scaling part of this equation that we believe very strongly. Like you want all your properties in a, just like what you're doing in hotels, right? Having them all in a very kind of close physical space where you can get those scale advantages. So that's why we're only in two buildings in Philly. We're only in really, you know, like a 10-minute radius in Sevierville.
Nice. And what kind of properties are they? Single family cabins?
Single family cabins. six-bedroom cabins, five-bedroom cabins, you know, in beautiful HOAs that have the pool, indoor pool, putt-putt, waterfall, all that fun stuff.
Are you seeing any oversaturation in that market? Tell me about that.
Yeah, no, that market, amazing market. So, you know, we were fortunate to get in early, buy off market, so we weren't chasing deals.
What year did you get in there?
2020. Although I will plug for Liz, she started talking about it in 2017 when everything was half the price. So I, with a master's degree and with the investment banking background, did not believe her. She was absolutely right. She'll listen to her. We, you know, but we did eventually start buying in 2020.
Yeah. Because I saw in 2021, I don't know if it's the rest of Smokies, but at least Gatlinburg had like a 60 something percent jump in appreciation, average appreciation. Joshua Tree, I think, saw an 81% jump in 2021. I mean, I think those are like number one and number two in the entire country.
It's wild. Yeah.
That's crazy, right?
It's wild. Yeah. And so, you know, obviously the builders that come in and built a lot more supply. The nuance is, you know, just like every market has a nuance, right? The nuance is like the supply is a certain, the new supply is a certain type of product. So you want to make sure that your product can differentiate, you know, from our product can differentiate by better design, by the location, right? By the amenities that we have versus the newer cabins that are generally smaller, a little further away. They don't have the same kind of look and feel as a traditional log cabin. So there again, these little things in these markets that the more time you play in them, you kind of learn like, oh, these are some of the leverage points. And once we learn that, you know, we definitely try to push into that advantage. But look, the market definitely has become more oversaturated. There's a lot more supply. Our revenue definitely has declined for 2021, but our basis is lower. And, you know, we're top 90% across, you know, we benchmark on AirDNA, our performance every single month, and we're still top 90%. So overall market down, but relatively speaking, we're doing well.
Your biggest partner in a real estate deal is always your lender. For me, I prefer using someone I know, like, and trust, whether you're looking for commercial loans, residential loans, bridge loans, DSCR loans, no debt to income ratio, no tax returns. My guy, Chris Groves, has got you. As seen on episode 77 and episode 142, Chris is a good friend of mine and is doing a special offer for podcast listeners, $2,500 off of your closing costs and or appraisal fees. Visit grovescapital.com/richdrummers to book a free call. Again, it's grovescapital.com/richdrummers to book a free call. Now back to the show.
Have you considered selling some of the properties that you have in Gatlinburg or the Sevierville, rather, and
No.
Moving some of that equity into other opportunities?
No, we haven't. We very much believe in buying and holding. We want to hold these assets forever, really, and pass it on to our kids and having them step up their basis. There's never a tax issue. We really like these assets. We believe in the Sevierville Smoky Mountains market. Now, it's going to have its volatility up and down, right? Mm-hmm. But I believe that we're really good operators, and we have 30-year fixed mortgages. You know, we have fixed mortgages on these things. We've constructed in a way where like it's very durable, and we want to hold it all the way through. We've also done, you know, cost segregation, bonus depreciation on all the properties. So we'd have to like 1030, you know, we got to do a bunch of unnatural acts. So what we'd rather do instead of stripping out the equity there is go do more arbitrage units, right? Get more cash flow there, go buy more properties, wait until the capital markets come back a little bit. And then we can refi some of those, maybe do a second, maybe do a portfolio. There are a bunch of things that you can do. When you have the equity there, like, you know, you can always be creative and—
Totally, and, yeah, you and, can and always get creative. So what do you guys do outside of the short-term rental stuff? Because it sounds like you're pretty hands-off with the operations. And how do you guys spend your time?
We spend probably half our time definitely on the short-term rental business. On the operational side, not as much. It's probably like an hour a day, review reports, checking with the team. We're really just focused on like buying properties and growth, right? So getting more arbitrage units, buying more properties. It's been a tough slog. The last property we bought was August of 22. So we haven't bought anything actually in almost 16 months.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, and you know, like, again, it's our personal capital. Like this isn't LP money. So we're very, very conservative, right? Like we don't want to lose our own money. Right?
Yeah.
So it's taking us a long time.
I'm like, if it's my own money, I can take more risk. I'm like, sweet. I'm like, I don't have investors. I can take a lot more risk and really be more aggressive. And even with the designs, with like some of these properties, if it's mine, I'm like, oh, let's get weird with the design. Let's get edgy. But if it's like investor capital, I'm like, that's where I have to be like way more conservative, because obviously I want to sleep good at night, but I also want to be a good custodian of other people's money.
Absolutely.
So I think the opposite. But I'm like, yes, this is just my deal. I'm like, I can get a little bit more aggressive and do some weird stuff. But anyway, so I'm listening.
Yeah, no, just me personally, like, what, you know, whether it's investor money or our capital, it's a conservative mindset. So we want to just like make sure that we weren't buying for the sake of buying, that we bought because like these are really good opportunities. And I would say, like, don't let the tax tail wag the dog, right? So like never buy something just for the tax. Like, we have a big tax bill this year, right? I just actually signed my personal returns today, so it was a pretty painful experience.
Why do you guys have such a big tax bill with all the real estate you
own? We didn't buy last year, so we couldn't bonus depreciate.
And you didn't have a lot of depreciation funneling through from all your other stuff?
We took it all out, all the cost section. They're all done.
Yeah. Okay.
They just have the small 39-year life property depreciation now.
Yeah.
So
let's talk about that. How come you made the decision, end of 2023, knowing, hey, you're at a depreciation, you're going to have a large tax bill. Why did you make the decision not to buy something else?
We couldn't find a good deal.
Based on the rate environment, like something that penciled or what?
I mean, the rate environment. So, you know, we have a few things, right? Like, one, the rate environment wasn't great. And you can make the argument, actually, the rate environment is worse now in April than it was in December. Rates are probably like half a point higher now than they were in December. But prices have come down in the last 4 months. We've seen, I think that's a benefit of like really looking into the market every single day. Like the pricing, the sellers have been more reasonable in pricing. So as the pricing's come down, things have, and then we're getting a little more certainty in the markets on the revenue side, the math is starting to work now.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work in 2023. And unfortunately, the clock ran out on us. There were a few things that, as I look back, we could have bought, but they would have been a mistake. Like, those are not had I bought anything I looked at in 23, I would have made a mistake, actually. So I'm glad I didn't.
What was the one asset last year that you maybe came the closest to pulling the trigger on? What was that deal?
It was this Smokies property that was offered to us off market. And, you know, we could have done a sub-2. We knew the seller. He was like a doctor. So we knew, you know, there wouldn't be any hair there. They were close, but ultimately we didn't pull the trigger because I just wasn't comfortable with, adding more risk into Smokies. And it was still overpriced, in my opinion. And fundamentally, I was like, should I let rate dictate it? Like, I just went back to first principles, right? The cash flow of that property is paramount, right? The rate will change, right? And I thought about it. I was like, I'm buying this for the rate more than I'm buying for the asset. And that's the wrong decision to make. And if I got to pay the tax, I'll pay the tax. And we walked away from that deal.
Mm.
And I don't regret that, right? Because I was right in how I was thinking about how that cash flow could continue to deteriorate, and it has continued to deteriorate this year. So better not to do that. So yeah, sometimes, you know, the best deals that you do are the ones that you don't do, actually.
No, I get it, dude. I think a lot of people, when they 1031, they think, oh, I have to find an upleg. And it's like, well, in all reality, based on the time of year when you actually sell the down leg, well, if you sell an asset in January, February, you got all the rest of the year to, even if you don't exercise the 1031, because maybe you don't want to be under the gun, as long as you buy something else by December and close on it, I believe it's maybe December 14th. I want to say it's got to be in service for like 14 days, I want to say, but you can utilize another cost seg and use the depreciation to offset maybe any potential, you know, taxes that are triggered from the sale. Or you could just eat it, like you said. So, I mean, it is what it is sometimes.
My accountant told me something. He was like, you should be happy you're paying taxes. And I was like, what are you talking about, man? And then he's like, look, it's because you made money.
Mm.
And I was like, all right, I still don't really buy into that, but like, maybe I'm just making myself feel better. If you didn't pay taxes, that means you're probably either really good investing or you didn't make any money. So,
yeah. But you know, if sometimes it's on the accountant. I had an accountant for like 11 years as an air traffic controller, and I kept her doing my personal for like a little bit. And she was trying to like, she didn't know real estate investing. She didn't know cost segs and all that sort of stuff. And if she told me that, hey, it's a good thing you're paying taxes, I'm like, oh, that's not a good thing. I think I got the wrong accountant, and I did in that scenario.
Yeah.
But no, I hear what you're saying. It's a good problem to have if you have a tax problem. That means you're making money. Things are going right in a lot of different areas.
Last year was good. Like, you know, can't complain. Last year, it was a good year.
That's good, man.
I'm lucky. I'm happy that we found this. You know, it was a lot of work. I'm happy we're really close, like you, I don't want to jinx it. Like we have offer accepted and, you know, we're really close on a contract. So get that done. And, you know, hopefully that'll
this be is the arbitrage market. Deal.
No, this is one we're buying.
Okay.
The arbitrage deal
is
already
where is this property? Tell us about it.
So we worked really hard to find this market. So I'm going to be a little more, circumspect, but you know, it's similarly a vacation rental market that, you know, has some really nice features. It's a little, you know, a little bit under the radar. That was kind of one of the screens that we utilize when we're looking at markets. I want to buy somewhere I can buy like 5-10 properties. I don't want to just be able to buy one here. You know, I don't believe in a scattershot approach. Only one here, one there. You can't reuse the same cleaners, handyman. Like, you don't really learn that market. You don't build any infrastructure. So this market, we think we can do like 5-10 properties, hopefully within the next 2 years. And once we get a few, I'll definitely let you know. I'll let the audience know.
Okay. Yeah, I like that, man. What can you give us, like a state? What part of the country is this thing?
It's in the Northeast.
That's all you're going to give us.
Awesome. I'll tell you offline.
Okay. All right. All right. Fair enough, man. Fair enough. So what's next for you, man, as you look out the rest of 2024? We're in April right now. We just started Q2. What's on the horizon for you, man? What are you most excited for?
I'm most excited to continue to buy this year. I think, you know, hopefully rates cooperate. No one has a good crystal ball, but I think we're seeing pricing come down or be a little bit more reasonable on the asset side. And there's still certain markets where, at least that we're tracking, you know, the RevPAR ADR continues to look strong. So that's where, you know, really excited about buying. We have this new building in Philadelphia that we're going to grow into 10, 15 units. Like, you know, we're going to do it in a responsible way. And yeah, just grow that, you know, grow those businesses where we're helping certain people that come to us and want to learn about Airbnb investing and kind of our playbook, helping them grow their respective businesses. So those are things that, those are the three. And we have two young kids too. So
yeah.
Paramount.
How old are the little ones?
My daughter is 2.5. My son is 6 months. So both in diapers, very young. And, you know, we didn't touch on it as much today, but my greatest accomplishment is not the properties or the business. My greatest accomplishment is exiting that investment banking job. It had a lot of perks. It was great. But being able to grow this business where, you know, we could support ourselves in New York City. We still have investment capital. We can grow and invest. But, you know, we're home. We're always with the kids. And watching them grow up, not having to travel, not having to do all that stuff when I was in banking has been really, like, the biggest thing. The biggest investment I'm going to make this year is, like, spending time with them and making sure that they grow up to be good citizens.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the true power of, you know, financial freedom. And everyone has a different definition of what that might mean to them. But I think the true power of financial freedom is being able to wake up every day and have the decision to work or not work or hang out with your kids, not hang out with their kids, and really just have the ability to go do whatever you want to do with your time. But it's funny because, I don't know, for me, I'm like, I got into this whole thing because initially I was like, oh, get a little passive income, financial freedom. But for me, I don't have kids. And so, you know, when I got or reached financial freedom, like, it's cool. I did some traveling and then I was like, what's next? And for me, happiness stems from growth and progress. And so I'm like, if I'm not growing and progressing and in the mix, I get bored quickly. So like, for me, that like everything I'm doing is not passive at all, but I fucking love this shit, you know? But there will be a point where I have kids. And, you know, I'm sure the pendulum will swing a little bit and I'll actually value being a little bit more hands-off, more passive. But for me right now, I'm growing it and I'm in the trenches right now, but I love it, dude. You know,
at different points of life, I didn't have my first kid until I was 41. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I wanted to spend my 30s and grow and build the business. But, you know, to your point, like, it's the freedom to do what you want. You know, like, I love, like, it's like, you know, I love the game too. Like,
yeah.
Business is a game.
It's addictive.
Right? It's addictive. It's like, let's go and, like, you know, it's like, you know, I played a lot of basketball and like it's just out competing, right? And I'm using your brains, using your network, using everything to compete against the other person, like, who wins, right? And the scoreboard is money, right? But ultimately, like, it's just an output. But it's, did I do the right thing? Did I create the right product? Have I supported my team that they can, you know, achieve, you know, their personal goals? Have I provided for my family? Like, and that all comes from, like, winning in business. And that's why I can just really, really enjoy. I love working. I love working. But it's great to work and then, like, instead of in an office or someone telling you what to do, like, okay, well, this time I'm going to do this and then see my kids and then I'm going to stop and I'm going to go back to work, right? Like having that flexibility is great. And you know, security too, right? It's like, it's my thing, right? Like it's a chore thing. No one can take it from you. Like I'll share a quick story. I was Easter dinner at my buddy's house and he had a friend, same bank, 15 years, grinded out 15 years, two kids as well. And he went out and have a cigarette. I was like, all right. Like, and I was like, why is he smoking? He's like, I never see smoke. He's like, I was just really stressed out right now. His boss just got laid off and he's like worried about what he's going to do. Right. And obviously like they're not going to like go to the poorhouse or anything, but he's worried. Right. It's like 15 years. And like, just like that, your security is all gone. You have two kids. So I just, you know, it just reinforced like why I believe entrepreneurship, like if you can do it and be successful at it, like that freedom that you earn is, there's nothing else like it.
Yeah. That's powerful, man. And I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, just the ability to wake up every day and be like, you know, rain or shine, whatever happens to me, like I'm going to figure this out. And having the confidence that you know that you can do it comes with all that, but it's like, you got to earn it and you got to go through it and you got to, but the same token, I mean, it's a beautiful thing, but it's not for everyone, man. Like the shit that I go through sometimes and the shit that all of us go through sometimes, I'd say most people, you know, they're not interested in that and that's totally fine, you know? But you know, if you can get through that stuff and you can, you know, and learn to enjoy it like I do and embrace, you know, the adversity and dealing with all the challenges and all the problems that are thrown your way and all the fires that you got to put out every single week. If you can learn to love it, the reward on the other side can be very powerful. And it's a beautiful thing, like you just mentioned.
It is. I'll just share another quick story. The entrepreneurship's like that being a Thanksgiving turkey. And I'll tell you why. You know, Thanksgiving turkey, right? It's, you know, you're a turkey. Your life, if you're a Thanksgiving turkey, your life is great, right? Like you're born and then you're in a farm. You're just like, it's great life that you lead right until November 25th, right? And then you're done.
Mm.
Now, I feel like it's kind of like when you're working, you know, like entrepreneurship. If you're just working a job, you're just kind of that Thanksgiving turkey that's, you know, you kind of have this nice life, but at a certain point, it's going to end for you. Like there's just no more of the 35-year jobs, right? Where you're just one career in your entire life, right? Something's going to happen along that point where you're going to get killed from that job and you're going to have to move to something else. Now, there are definitely situations where like you get lucky, like, you know, if you're the turkey that gets picked to go to the White House, right? They pardon you, you kind of go live this happy life. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the entrepreneurship part is like, are you the brave bird that can go out and like, I'm going to escape this farm and I'm going to go and like live the life that I want. Like you said, the entrepreneurship part, it's hard. 90% of businesses fail, right? Like if you escape that farm, like probably get eaten by a predator there.
But
if you can escape that and get that freedom, then like, I think that is like the goal that I want to be. I don't want to be in this simple life where, you know, it's going to be all great and great, great until one day I know 15 years later, I'm going to get knocked down and I'll go home to my family and be like, sorry, dad doesn't have a job anymore. I'm going to go look for a job. Like that's a really hard thing to think about and say, right? Like you got to take that risk. You might fail, but like, if you don't take that risk, the end is like a pretty predefined outcome. And that, you know, again, I don't think entrepreneurship is for everyone, but like if you believe that you have that in you that you can deal with all those problems that you talked about, right? Being a CEO, you get all the worst problems. Mm. All the problems that you can't solve all come to you, right? If it could be solved, you solve by your team, right? It all comes to you. So you get all the bad problems. But if you love that and you want to like, oh, give me the problems, I'm going to solve it, like then that is how you can be a successful entrepreneur. Like, it's just that game that I think you and I both really, really enjoy and get up in the morning and want to get after it.
I mean, business is game, it's a game in our reality. It's a powerful game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I appreciate you coming on, man. Where can the listeners get in touch with you?
The best way to reach me is on Instagram. You can reach me. My Instagram handle is Michael Chang B&B, MichaelChangB&B. So DM me there. Happy to speak with you.
There it is, my man. Well, appreciate you coming out, and we'll have to run it again next year sometime. He's Michael Chang. I'm Rich Summers. Listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you in the next one. Peace.